Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's April 1st, 2018, and welcome to episode 169 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find...
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalging, collecting, accumulating, fooling in April. I don't know, whatever. Many things having to do with retro computers. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and once again we have a relatively small table, but we are joined by our founder, David Grealish.
Hey, thanks.
How are you doing?
Real small, huh? Just the two of us.
Yeah.
We have a cozy round table today.
Yeah. So, RCR episode one was hosted by David.
Yeah.
And how far we haven't come, but oh well.
Can you believe it? In 2010, I didn't even, hadn't thought about it recently. That's a long time ago.
Yeah, no, I know. It's not quite into whatever the retro time period is, but pretty soon RCR itself will be retro.
Yeah.
I think actually Earl's podcast might be retro.
Oh, yeah.
Might be officially retro.
Retro Bits? Oh, yeah. That first podcast I started listening to.
Yeah.
I think it's 2005, if I'm not mistaken. And then next up would be the Retro Maccast, and they're still going. They're not doing it every week like they used to, but fairly regularly still. And that's 2006.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, long time.
I listened to both of those. Retro Maccast, I think they record them every week pretty much, but for some reason they seem to recently have done little episode dumps of like three in a row.
Oh, right. Yeah, because they're both traveling and stuff.
Yeah. So,
but hey, glad to be here.
It's
been a while.
So what have you been up to in your sort of recent life?
In personal life, I still live where I live, so the greater Atlanta area. Been having some job stuff going on. So like I just started a new job last week, so been having that going on. Mm-hmm. Kids growing up.
Yeah.
So got two adult kids now and have one in high school. And so it doesn't sound like much, but that's a lot.
I can believe that would occupy a lot of time.
Yeah, but I haven't, and I looked, I hadn't really podcasted. I've done some interviews, which I'll mention later, but haven't been involved in a regular podcast for just about a year now. So since the history of personal computing wrapped up, so it's kind of nice to do it again.
Yeah, that was a fun podcast. I recall sort of listening to it and thinking, like wanting to jump in. But,
oh, yeah. It was another mini roundtable, sort of.
Yeah. So let's see. So I guess I'm once again the hosting, but I don't really have much of a topic. Here's the thought I had on the host topic, which is pretty thin. It's episode 169, and the hex value of 169, the way we represent it in hexadecimal, is A9. In 6502 machine language, that is LDA immediate mode, or load accumulator. And so I thought maybe we could talk about accumulation.
Okay.
That's the threat.
Cool.
So for me, mainly, accumulation has all been one-directional and something that I need to start confronting, just because I've got basically two rooms just full of stacks of things. I'm curious to know. So you, I know, have at least at a couple of points kind of downsized, making room in your garage or whatever.
Right.
How did you do it? Or like, what did you keep? What's your current situation?
Well, and first let me give you my little, what I think is a funny spiel here.
Sure.
I'll ask you a question. So what's the difference between a collector and a hoarder?
Ah, should I answer?
Yeah, I mean it's sort of real, but it's also kind of a joke too. But it's, yeah. it's but I'll answer it. So I'll tell
day
you
of the
it's
week
space.
Yeah. No, I think
technically you're not a hoarder. Totally... Yeah, unless it starts getting in the way of your living space, right? So so obviously if you have a lot of money and you can just have unlimited space, you're kind of technically not a hoarder because it's not invading your personal space. But anyway, so, you know, but it's kind of a joke too, because obviously a lot of collectors are sort of hoarders.
Yeah. Well, so. one sort of idea that I've heard I think it wasn't even in a retro computing context. It was just a general collectors versus hoarders discussion somewhere, you know, and the distinction they made was whether you display it or not, you know, so.
Yeah, there you go.
That's roughly the same thing. Like if you hide it from people, you are a hoarder.
Right.
If you show that's it to true. People, you are a collector.
Right. Generally, collectors are proud of their collections.
Right.
And they generally at least try to take care of it. Sometimes that can get out of hand because if you have too much, right? It's hard to keep up with it. But yeah, that's exactly right. So back to what you asked me. So really what it – so at one point – so early on – do you know what? This is also the 25th anniversary of when I started collecting computers. So I was in the Army, and then my wife and I got – moved back to the United States, and before we moved back, I was like, you know, I think it'd be cool to start collecting computers, and most people thought it was junk, and so it was really easy to come by. Anyway, so that's when I started.
Those were the days.
So at one point, I've never had a giant collection, but I've had a lot of computers in my time, and I think I've pretty much owned every significant American-made, you know, micro personal computer at this point, at some time, not all at once. But at one point, I always took up the garage. So I always had the entire garage and one car starting off earlier on, then like two car garages. And I don't mean like a hoard, like it's fully, you know, like the Indiana Jones warehouse or anything, but just, you know, we couldn't park in it. And then I generally have always had an office, and then the office, I generally had it full of stuff. And I've always been pretty good, and my wife's been supportive, where I didn't really invade the house with other stuff, but I've had quite a bit of stuff. So I guess around 20, I don't know. So it started this podcast like 2010. I'm going to say about 4 or 5 years ago, you know, and life got busy and other things going on. We moved a bunch of times. It kind of just became clear to me. I had a lot of stuff in the garage, and for the most part, it sat there getting dirty. Mm-hmm. You know, it was really hard for me to keep up with it and keep it clean because it's a garage and you open and close it and stuff's blowing in. And I didn't really have room in the house. And so I just decided, you know, this doesn't do me any good if I can't ever have time to get to it, it's just kind of getting dirty. And so that's when I sort of made a conscious decision to downsize. Mostly just to find, you know, and there's also been, fortunately or unfortunately, well, both, there's also been times through my life where I've had to raise money, and I've actually sold things. Like I had a really nice Next Cube, you know, one time, and I don't remember what happened, but we really needed the money. So I sold it. My original Lisa, I ended up selling that at some point. So things like that happened too.
Yeah. I know with like, there's a certain thing that I think you always need to avoid doing. And I have completely failed to avoid doing that, but, which is that you get so much stuff that there's no space to work with anything. You know, so I can't, like, if I want to try to, you know, see if something's working and try to, you know, maybe either put it on display or get it out of my way or something, I need a surface.
A lot of prep time just to work on it.
Well, and just a place to put it, but the surface that I would have put it on is full of, other, you know, piles of other things. So yeah. That I do seriously believe that that is kind of, like, keeping me from getting through what I have, but... I mean, many things I got sort of explicitly, but then some things I got that came along with things I wanted or that I saved from being trashed or whatever. And, you know, like I don't need, you know, however many. Like I remember I went one time, actually I had to drive several hours out to go get a couple of sort of Lego sets. You might have seen these at, I think Evan Koblenz has a, done a couple of like VCF exhibits with these like Legos, the Lego motors and things that you connect to like an Apple II or whatever and,
oh,
and
yeah, run with yeah.
the logo. But so someone advertised one of these. It was in Pennsylvania somewhere, so I had to go a ways to get it. And I talked to him ahead of time and he said, yeah, I will sell these to you, but you have to take like these 8 Apple IIe setups as well. It's like, all right.
Right. So they use you as a, right.
So now I have like, you know, this, like as I record, I'm looking in the corner at a stack of monitors, you know, which I don't actually need them. And in fact, actually none of these things I need. What I really had for myself, this idea that I was gonna sort of like clean things up, photograph them, document them, you know, sort of make sure that I knew how everything worked, and possibly keep one of the sort of hardware examples. But then once the documenting's done, I don't need it. I'm not going to use it. If someone else, you know, would mm-hmm. love to play with it, I would rather they were doing that.
Right.
So.
And I think that's, you know, that's sort of the realization, or that's another way of looking at it, is prioritizing, like, I only have so much time, and what do I really care about? And sort of, yeah, I'd really want to keep this. I really like to do stuff with this one. And you know what I mean? And then you just have to make the tough call. And, you know, I think the downside nowadays is in my opinion, it's kind of harder to, I don't know if it makes sense, but it's almost harder to get rid of stuff. Like eBay is not as a friendly place anymore. The shipping is so expensive, and I just hate trying to ship anything, but you know, so if you want to sell it that way.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's, I mean, eBay isn't great, but there's also, I have to say, there's also a tiny little, I don't know, mercenary thought in my brain that says, you know, if you're going to sell the stuff, you better start doing it soon, because I think there's going to be a point after which all the people who care are gone.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to want the stuff. and that would actually be fairly tragic if it turned out that I, you know, just sort of had something that somebody wanted stacked up at the bottom of a pile somewhere until they were no longer able to enjoy it.
Yeah. So,
but there, I mean, I think there's going to be a coming market crash. Although it does seem like the prices have continued to grow, you know, mm-hmm. terribly. But that can't last. So that's another motivating factor, is that, like, you know, I sunk a lot of money into this, and even though I don't necessarily want to get rich, I don't necessarily want to just, you know, get nothing out of what I put into it. But
I think Apple, at least, you know, again, for now, is generally always a good bet. I mean, that you can at least get your money back out of it, or, you know, if not make, you know, like if you have a bunch of different Apple IIs, they've certainly not, they're not like they're super valuable, but they're worth something, you know, and they've consistently kind of gone up
in
value. So you can always turn them around, I guess, pretty easily. Like a Lisa, I guess you've seen how those, man.
Yeah.
Well, with minimum Lisa, if it's totally clean and actually working and stuff, well, it's got to be, what, $2,000 now? You know,
it's conceivable, yeah.
Even without a profile and stuff?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, and I think, you know, I'm willing to say that, you know, like some of the value I got out of it was the ability to document it and the ability to have it for a while and stuff. You know, I don't want to turn into a businessman about this, but nevertheless, I do, you know, I kind of dread the possibility that I would wind up in a situation where, no matter what I'm charging, nobody wants to take these things, and I'm actually having to put them in the recycler. You know?
Right. Oh, that's the other thing I was going to mention too, is it seems, at least, you know, it's different everywhere, but like in our area, there's a lot less sort of, like there used to be a lot less sort of mom and pop. I don't know if that's how it would be, but independent mm-hmm. thrift stores, or, you know, charity organizations, you know, not, you know, Goodwill and Salvation Army are, you know, great organizations and stuff. And, but I know Goodwill, I'm not sure they're saving this stuff anymore. My understanding is that because I know anytime I go to Goodwill, there's no computer stuff hardly. Right. Is that they sort of like send it off to any computer stuff to specific locations where they then recycle it, or they pass it along to recyclers. They're not trying to resell it, or, you know, I don't know. I mean, there used to be that Austin Goodwill that was specifically selling, you know, valuable old computers, but they don't anymore. So I don't know what's going on with that.
Well, yeah, I think so. I believe the Austin Goodwill, they had a little vintage computer museum, you know, and so they obviously had somebody there that had some expertise, and I think they actually sold off that museum as well. But my impression is that most of the in-person Goodwill stores that you go into don't really have much except really kind of modern things. We mentioned actually in the last episode shopgoodwill.com, which is, it is a place where I think several different Goodwill locations can put things up for, like, eBay, like,
yeah, like auctions. A clearinghouse thing.
Yeah. So some computer stuff goes there. But when I looked a couple weeks ago for the purpose of talking about it, there was, you know, it was mainly just like Atari 2600s. And my searches for Apple revealed nothing, you know?
Mm, so yeah,
it's an interesting issue.
I will say too, lastly, then, in closing out the topic, is one choice I made. So I did, you know, I really downsized, and so, you know, my specific love first love in old computers has always been the Mac, and then the Apple Lisa. So I have an Apple Lisa, which I'm restoring, and I have a Plus, Mac Plus, and I have a few other Macs, and but also I had a Commodore 64 early on, so I have a few different Commodore 64s and Commodore 64 related stuff, and that's pretty much what I have as far as mainstream microcomputers, you know, old personal computers. And then I kind of started specializing in handhelds, and I felt like that was a really, they were small and they're still relatively cheap to acquire.
Right.
And so I started getting different handhelds. And in fact, I'm going to do my exhibit this year, the Vintage Computer Festival Southeast on handhelds. But also, I have some reproductions, and I think that's kind of an interesting side note, you know. So I have a few of those now, and I have some other miscellaneous stuff. But that's really it. So now I have one wall in the garage, and I promised my wife, I guess it's been 2 years now or so, that I'd get her where she could park in the garage.
Yeah.
So now she can park in the garage, and I just have shelves against one wall that I still have quite a bit of stuff. You know, I still have books and magazines, and that, which I really enjoy magazines a lot.
Uh-huh.
But anyway.
Yeah, that's good. And I, you know, I'm hoping that I will have a chance to just kind of sit down and get through stuff and start getting things out so that it really is like the things that I care about, the things that I want to use are the ones that I still have. A lot of the things that I have gotten, I've gotten because I thought it would be kind of cool to learn how to use them. You know, so I never used the Commodore 64 really, but I had a couple friends who had them. And, you know, so I've got a little pile of those that I hope to someday move sprites around the screen and do interesting things with that. And
right.
Same thing with everything, like the TI-99/4A I have, or, you know, the PET or all these things. Like I kind of want to have the experience of learning how to use them and then using them and, you know, whatever. But if I sort of add all those times up, it's going to take years. I'm sure it's not like it's that much more trivial now for me to learn all the like memory architecture of the VIC-20 or something like that. I mean, like, you know, like it was hard then and it'll take some time now. Maybe I have a more context, but it's still not trivial. So it'll be fun, but the time might be unrealistic.
Right. Right. To that degree. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're going to try to program it and stuff.
Yeah. It's kind of depressing, you know,
just play a game on it.
Well, yeah,
that you can do right away.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's a certain point. It's tricky to find the right balance between like what you really want to try to experience on the real hardware and what you could just be as easily doing in MAME or something.
All right. But yeah.
Anyway. Well, okay. So I suppose we can call that the topic.
And today's Apple's anniversary. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Mention that April 1st, Apple was founded in 1976.
Happy birthday, Apple.
Yeah.
You haven't changed a bit.
Right.
Okay, so I'll just mention a couple of things that listeners have written in. And it's not actually, David, to fill you in on how things have been going. Mostly the listener feedback winds up being just items of interest and news that listeners sent in. So
okay.
So it winds up being not super distinct but from the other parts of the show. But so I'll just mention a couple of things here. So the first one is one that Mark sent us over Twitter, which is it's on a site that says Rescue 1130, which I assume is kind of like a play on Rescue 911, a 2014 pickup of an IBM 1130 system and more. And this is a particular entry called Historical Recreation and Restoration of an Original 4th on the IBM 1130. And it sort of talks about the creation of 4th in its original form in 1968 by Charles Moore. And apparently it was on an IBM 1130 that this language started. The goal of the project, this is not reporting on the project's success, it is reporting on the project's commencement. But the goal is basically to try to get the kind of like original 4th running. And it's not a very long read, but it's kind of an interesting project. Sort of talking about how it goes together, and it's a little bit challenging because this is the first, you know, this is the beginning of 4th, the first 4th, you could say, but in later versions there would be documentation, you know, but trying to get the initial version running without much guidance is sort of a challenge.
You got to kind of figure it out.
Well, and actually the other thing about Forth too is that it's a very extensible language. I mean, like, I think that's basically how it works, is that, you know, there's some primitives, but then you just keep defining new verbs or whatever they are, you know, new functions.
That's got to be tough to go from, you know, to try to go backwards, you know, to a more primitive version of even something, you know, because that's not intuitive whatsoever, to try to figure out, right? Because who knows? Because it makes sense going forward. Like, well, logically, it might have evolved this way or done that. And I don't know about going backwards. Yeah, it's a neat looking computer. I like the control desk or console, I guess you call it, or whatever.
Oh, yeah. On the side, I haven't clipped through all of these, but there's on the sidebar, there's a little picture of at least part of it. And it's, you know, nice blue, blue and black.
Yeah,
and
IBM blue.
Nice colorful keyboard. In, you know, mounted in a desk, which is probably attached to a card puncher or something.
Yeah. Still pretty small, right? For, you know, compared to obviously a decade earlier or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. It does. It looks like, you know, it could fit in the corner of a room.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it looks like an interesting project. I'd be interested to, so the article that we're linking to is just March 17th. So it's a couple weeks ago. It is a project in progress. Anyway, thanks for sending that link. I think it'll be interesting to follow that. And then, so Tony sent a couple of things over email, actually in a couple of different emails. But so most recently, he pointed out the existence of a Jupiter Ace emulator. Well, actually, there's some tools, but the Jupiter Ace micro emulator, which it allows you to emulate a Jupiter Ace, which is these, to stick with the Forth theme, these little kind of like ZX80 sized things that ran Forth. It seems so intriguing to me. They're completely, the crazy thing about these things is that they're like the ZX80, and that they're like these supposed to be the cheap accessible computers that the masses could buy, right? The Timex Sinclair's version, $99 or whatever, right?
But you had to learn Forth.
Yeah, we had to learn Forth, you know, they're supposed to be sort of mass cheap products, and yet, I mean, you just cannot find them now. And if you try to get one, you know, if you do find one, they're so expensive, and it's insane. Because I mean, like, when you get it, it's still a little cheap piece of plastic, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, but they definitely didn't make as many of these as the ZX80 and 81 and Thomas Sinclair and all that.
Yeah, no, I think this didn't.
I don't think I've ever seen one of these in person. I've seen pictures and stuff many, many times. But.
Yeah. I've never seen one for sure. We link to this, you know, probably, I don't know, once every 10 episodes or something like that, you know, the Jupiter Ace comes up, but just because it's so neat, the idea that it would be a little Forth machine.
But, I guess I never realized it was English either.
Yeah. Well, so that's part of why I think it's less available, but I also don't think it took off really. I mean, I assume it was kind of directly competing with the ZX80 and you know, things that came after it. And so, there, fairly recently, like a year or two ago, the remains of the Jupiter Ace intellectual property were sold off. I mean, I remember, it might actually have been more like 5 years ago, but I remember there was an auction on eBay for basically the remains of Jupiter Ace that had like prototypes and plans and software and stuff like that. I don't really know what happened to that. I don't think the actual auction sold, but...
Oh, really?
Yeah, maybe at some point I'll find it and I can link at least back to the episode we talked about it in. But it's always been a little bit intriguing.
I was gonna see if there's one on eBay anywhere. Hey, there is one.
Really?
Let's see from the United Kingdom. It is buy it now for $1,401.40.
Yeah, sounds about right.
It says mint. Yeah, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, with a lot of these things, when you get it and you get it and you put it on your desk. And people who know what it is go, whoa, well, that's cool. And everyone else goes, you know, they sort of toss it aside so they can put something down on your desk.
Right.
So, and actually the other link that Tony sent a little while ago was a link to a Register article that it was from 2012. And it says the Jupiter Ace is 30. So you can do all the rest of the math that is required there. I guess it's 36 now.
Right.
But it's kind of a neat little like review of what the Jupiter Ace was and kind of like its impact and stuff, or lack thereof, I suppose.
Yes, that's well after the ZX80 though, in 81. That's what, 2 years or so after, isn't it? One or two. I mean, for the 81, I think the ZX81, I want to say it was 81, 1981. Am I right? I have to look it up now.
That's a good question. I don't know. I sort of assumed that it didn't have to do with the year, but the processor, but, you know, like it's the ZX80 plus one.
Right.
But it might coincidentally have also been the year.
Yeah. So the 81 was 1981 and the ZX80 was 1980. Yeah. But you're right. I think it was called the ZX80 because it had a Z80 processor.
Right.
But it just was coincidental. But maybe that's why they decided, well, it's 1981 now, so.
Yeah.
Doorstop computers.
What? Sorry? Oh, yes. Right. Exactly. They're
doorstop
red-shaped
computers. You can, yeah. Kick them.
All right. Anyway, so I think we'll leave the listener feedback at that point. There were a couple that other things that we got, but we'll deal with them some other time.
Okay.
So we can actually just move to our own items of interest and news. And so, David, you have the first group here.
So I thought I would talk a little bit about there's a lot of good computer history related documentaries coming out this year. So there'll be links in the show notes, of course, for all this. So the first one. I'm not sure if these are in order of when they'll actually be released. Some of it's a little gray on some of them. But so anyway, the first one, it's the documentary about General Magic. So General Magic was the name of a company, and it actually started with an Apple. And I know a few Macintosh luminaries were involved with it, like Andy Hertzfeld. And God, I'm going to kick myself. Who's the guy to make HyperCard?
That wasn't Bill Atkinson, was it?
Yeah. There you go. Bill Atkinson. Yep.
Okay.
So of course he made, you know, obviously he was very involved in the Mac interface and a lot, you know, part of the original Mac team. Here's another one for you, Paul. So who was, the woman, you know, who was on the original Mac team and like, she's known for like standing up to Steve Jobs and, she was like Hungarian. What was her name?
Oh,
you know what I'm talking about? Oh,
I don't know. See, I don't know.
Hoffman, right? Hoffman?
Oh, I think, I think I do know who you mean.
What's her name?
She had a character, actually, in the movie.
In that Steve Jobs movie.
Yeah.
I'm going to find out. Joanna Hoffman.
Yeah, okay, that's right.
All right. So probably more people know about the Apple Newton, which, of course, was also an internal Apple, you know, development. This was more, it turned out to be a PDA device that Sony sold, and Motorola came out with one. But at General Magic, it was called Magic Link. I'm sorry, it's called Magic Cap, was like the operating system that ran. Mm-hmm. So it was internal in Apple, and then it got spun out into its own company. And then ultimately, they were trying to create I think they want to say it's a smartphone, but like an intelligent communicator PDA. So in any case, there's a documentary coming out, and I know it's going to premiere at the Tribeca, is that how you say it?
Mm-hmm.
Film festival in New York, which I believe is next month. And anyway, link in the show notes to that page, and you can see a little preview, and it's very interesting. And ultimately, you know, the devices were failures. They weren't really considered successful. They were kind of too soon, sort of like the Apple Newton. But a lot of people went on to be involved in a lot of other projects, you know, and had their hands on a lot of other things. And I'm not going to try to look it up and say who they all are. But just go to the website and check it out. So it's very interesting. That is next month. Next, there is an Apple Newton documentary. It's called, let me go to the website. So Love Notes to Newton. Did you know about this one?
This one? Yeah, I'd come across this before. I don't know if we linked to it here, but I knew that it was, they were working on it. I follow a couple of, you know, Newton people on Twitter. I think there used to be shirts. Are there shirts still?
Yeah. Yeah, it was an Indiegogo. It had an Indiegogo, you know, campaign. And then people got shirts for that mm-hmm. supported it and stuff. But I know that, the gentleman making it, his Noah. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I have a little part in this documentary I'm very happy about. Now, it's in final production, so... So I'm not, you know, sometimes editing has to happen, so I don't know how much will actually be in there. Right. And I'm not talking about an interview. I actually created this little sort of a quick short history of the personal computer and handheld computing, which also includes the Newton and stuff. So he's gonna use that in the documentary. So we'll see. Hopefully he'll use it all, but we'll see what happens. But this documentary is more focused on, it's going to have something to do with the history, of course, of the Newton, but it's more focused on the user community that rose up around the Newton while it was alive, but then even more so once it was killed. Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, the short story here is, you know, this is a project by John Sculley, and most people feel like, oh, Steve Jobs came back to Apple and he just, you know, he got a lot of glee in killing this project because it was kicking, you know, right. John Sculley, right? But some people say that's not true. It was really a matter of budgetary cuts that, you know, Apple needed to focus on their core business, which is the Macintosh. But anyway, so this is more about the user communities, you know, rising up and supporting the Newton for so long, and that there's even people who still really love it and feel like, you know, what it could have been. It's generally considered a failure, like even the magic cap devices, you know, general magic stuff.
The story does reverberate a little bit with, or you know, resonate, I guess is what I meant, with like the Apple III story too. You know, like there's a kind of an initial problem that gets solved, but not in time to, but sort of the public perception is at that point already like headed down the road somewhere else.
Exactly.
So.
And that totally happened with the Apple III and the Newton. The Newton, I think it just got beat up too by like the Doonesbury cartoons, and then like Simpsons made fun of it, and some of it, just people really enjoyed making fun of it, and then it just, the perception was, you know, it's no good, it's not worth it. That is my opinion. I think some of the other issues with it was, you know, it promised a lot, which it didn't ultimately deliver. It cost a lot for the time, and it was probably a little too big. Now, it was pretty great for the time, how small it was, but ultimately, you know, it's supposed to be like a pocket device, and it, you know, it was like 1.5 times bigger than a Palm Pilot, which came out a little bit later.
Yeah.
But anyway, really looking forward to this. He's got a lot of good interviews. Interesting, both documentaries, they interview John Sculley. And so that's interesting. And then other people involved. So that's Love Notes and Newton. Then there's the General Magic. And let me get back to the notes here. Oh, and the Apple Newton one, he was trying to get it done in time for the 20th anniversary of its cancellation, which was the end of February. And he was not able to do that. So I think it's going to premiere at a Macintosh convention. I'm trying to think what it's called, but I believe it's like July. So I know he's trying to get it done by then. So it doesn't have an official release date yet. The next documentary is called The Augmentation of Douglas Engelbart. And on the website, it says in theaters November 12th. And I believe it may premiere at the Computer History Museum. Oh, and that coincides with the, what anniversary would that be? 30 years? 68? 40 years? 50 years? The 50th anniversary is what's called the demo.
Yeah, the mother of all demos.
The mother of all demos, thank you.
That is a... How could it be so long ago?
Yeah. And so, you know, this is this particular, what Douglas Engelbart and his, you know, his peers and staff did at their research institute in Stanford University. It really was also the mother of what we all use right now. So a lot of its research and the work he did led up to and fed into the work that went on at Xerox PARC. And then ultimately, of course, then what fed into and people actually migrated to Apple. And then in all fairness to Microsoft, people also came out of Xerox PARC and Stanford and all these, you know, they all fed into these two things. And of course, you know, we live in a world where it's obviously dominated by the Mac and Windows. Mm-hmm. So all tracing their roots back here. So that looks really good. I actually interviewed the producer of this, and I'll give more details about that at the end. The other one, here's another one that I'm really interested in. I supported it. It's called Steve Jobs's Choices. Originally, it was called Firing Steve Jobs. And then, interestingly, they decided to cancel that on Kickstarter. And then they explain it here, I think, where then they decided to rename it Steve Jobs's Choices. And they put it on Indiegogo, which apparently it has ended. They're trying to raise €25,000. They've only raised €3,670.
So I wonder what's going to happen.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, everything. I know they have a lot of footage and stuff where they interview people. But it's made by the guys from 8-Bit Generation, who have already done a couple of other documentaries. Which, yeah. Do you remember what they are? I guess one's just called the 8-Bit, isn't it? Documentary or?
Well, let's see. The Commodore Wars is one they list at the bottom, and then Easy to Learn, Hard to Master, The Fate of Atari.
Mm-hmm.
I have not seen either of those. They are both still on my list of things I need to see. But
yeah, and I've seen both, and I thought they were pretty good.
Okay.
So junk food films, and there's Tommaso Walliser and Bruno Grandpa.
Right. Yeah, and also, and somehow he's got a particularly memorable name, I guess. But I remember this being, I think it was the Commodore Wars that was premiered at the Computer History Museum not that long ago. There was an event. I remember people taking photos of that and stuff.
So this is in the works. Again, links in the show notes. You can go look at the little teaser video. So unknown when it's going to come out. I think, does it say here, get this perk? I'm trying to look when it says. I want to say they want to try to get done by this year. But...
Right. But I wonder, I do kind of wonder what the fact that the campaign was unsuccessful means, right? You know, the deadline may no longer be valid.
Right.
So
now, of course, you know, the biggest difference that I can see with Kickstarter, you know, Kickstarter, you set a goal, you either reach it and get the money or you don't reach it and you don't get any money.
Right.
With Indiegogo, they have what, like this campaign is what's called a flexible goal. So you get it however much you raise.
Oh, I see. And okay. So they're.
Yeah, they got the money, but okay. I don't know. Yeah.
So I guess that probably means that there's something's going to happen, which is good.
So that's Steve Jobs' choices. The last one is, here's a article that Google is now working on a documentary about Grace Hopper. And Grace Hopper is huge, important person in computer history who, most people just don't know much about. She was a Navy officer. She ended up being, I believe, she may not have this... be the highest ranking woman naval officer anymore, but she achieved that. You know, I think she was like an admiral, so that's one or two stars, you know, equivalent. She's known as being the mother of the programming language, as far as like she had a huge part in developing COBOL, and then supposedly finding the first bug, which was literally a moth that got stuck in the electromechanical computer that IBM developed. So it actually had mechanical relays. It wasn't fully electronic. So a moth got trapped inside of, you know, a real, you know, mechanical device relay thing. So.
Yeah. I always wondered if that was for real, but it is a great story.
Well, there's a picture of where there's a moth taped into a book and then she wrote the first bug.
My impression was that she was pretty funny. I mean, like, you know, she had a pretty good sense of humor as well as just being, like, very smart.
Yeah. I know if you search on YouTube, you can see an interview she did with David Letterman, like, back in the 80s. And that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So check that out.
That is actually, I mean, like, of course, the video quality being from that time is not great. But that is pretty entertaining to see that interview. And I believe she had in that interview also, she has these... like teaching aids that the nanoseconds which was basically like a foot long length of wire that she would, you know, use to sort of demonstrate like how far this electrical signal travels in a nanosecond, or like, you know, sort of gives you a sense of what it means.
I seem to remember that too. I'll have to watch it again. In this picture in the article, so this is like in the 50s, I believe she's sitting in front of the a UNIVAC control device. It's like, it's the same UNIVAC, I think it'll say UNIVAC 1, in fact, where it's also had notoriety for being like the first real computer on television during the Eisenhower presidential.
Oh, the election.
Who he ran against. That one, say 52 maybe or something. Yeah. And then the computer projected that Eisenhower would win, and the news people, they didn't believe it. They didn't think it was accurate. Because like it made that prediction with like 1% of the results. And so they didn't go with it. And then they learned, you know, then they learned it was right.
Yeah.
So I think that's what she's sitting in front of, because it's pretty, no other one looks like it. But there you go.
Cool. So we'll have plenty to watch in the, maybe not in the lazy summer months, since some of those will be later.
Yeah.
But there'll be things to watch in some lazy summer months.
Yeah, very exciting. I love documentaries. So it's my favorite kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think I really wish I had actually seen more of them, because they are piling up for me. But it's excellent that they exist, because, you know, increasingly it's hard to interview people. You know, they're becoming less and less sort of available, you might say, tactfully.
Hey, just by the way, Paul, so you had mentioned, you know, that very last, because we talked about Joanna Hoffman and that very last Steve Jobs film, which I guess, is it just called Jobs? I have it. Is it, it's either Steve Jobs or Jobs.
Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I think the one before that was called Jobs, right? With Ashton Kutcher or whatever. But did you guys discuss that movie on the show when it came out?
I don't know.
Much,
oh, quite possibly not.
That's a very interesting movie. Do you like that movie? Which is not a documentary.
I mean, right. I mean, I think it was interesting. I think it did help kind of knowing the basic plot points, like the basic outline of the real story before going in there. Because you can sort of see where the dramatic liberty was taken.
Oh, yeah.
But
I'm really fascinated by that movie. It's actually, I try to go to, whenever I go to movies, my intent is to have a good time. Right. So I'm like, I'm going to have a good time, enjoy this movie. So I enjoyed the movie, but I was sitting there in the movie theater and go like, oh my God, you know, this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong.
Right.
And then, you know, I ultimately bought it and I've watched it a few times and I'm just so fascinated by it because, well, first off, all they needed to do is simply like open up and say, based on a true story. If they just put that at the beginning, which I know maybe most people don't think it's all 100% accurate, but I just wish they kind of did that. But it's fascinating because it's so made up, the some of the events and the timetable and everything else. Yeah, it's funny how like the scenes with, you know, where like Wozniak's getting kind of ticked off at Jobs,
right,
which never happened. But it's like you sort of cheer for that.
Yeah.
And frankly, the scene, you know, after Steve Jobs got forced out of the company, he never saw or spoke to John Sculley ever again in his life. And of course, in the movie, he talks to him two more times at least, and they're just before big presentations.
Right.
But when they have this scene where John Sculley is talking to him about what happened in that boardroom, it's so amazing how that's actually really accurate. And that's not actually portrayed correctly in a lot of, you know, movies and stories and stuff about it. And so it's just really weird how that, you know. Anyway, I get off of that.
It is interesting. I was reminded, actually, just quite recently, you know, now going way off from retro computing, saw The Death of Stalin, which is...
Oh, I wanted to see that.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it was entertaining or whatever. My wife, though, you know, afterwards is like, you know, all these things, like, because it is based on, like, real people, real events in various ways, but of course, you know, made comedic. But, I think she was having a hard time kind of enjoying it just because she knows the actual players and stuff well enough that, you know, it was just sort of frustrating the liberties that they took. You know, obviously it was supposed to be funny, but.
It was a comedy?
It is a dark comedy. It's by the same guy that made Veep and In the Loop and stuff like that. It's that. And I didn't realize that initially, you know, like when I first heard of this movie, that was like, I hadn't connected these things together, but.
Cause wasn't there another like biographical kind of like, you know, mainstream movie that came out about Stalin that wasn't a comedy or is that the same one?
I don't know. I was only.
Yeah,
sort of
I have to look into that now.
Paying attention to the Iannucci stuff, but.
Cause I remember I saw some preview about a movie about Stalin and it seemed serious and I wanted to see it and then I never saw it. And that'd be interesting if it turned out it was that one. It's a comedy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's so, yeah, it's, I don't know if you've seen Veep or In the Loop, and there's sort of a British analog to Veep that preceded In the Loop, and I'm losing the name of it right now, but it's all sort of about internal politics and interactions and things like that. You know, in the Death of Stalin case, it's basically just about, you know, all these people sort of trying to take charge.
Yeah.
In various ways. So anyway, but
listeners, write in.
Yeah. the connection was supposed to be basically just that, like being loosely based on the truth is, can be an impediment to enjoyment.
Right. But,
all right. Let's see. So I actually have something which is fairly similar to mention, and it's only one link. And so it's sort of, I guess maybe just adding to this previous topic, but, Just a couple of days ago, the Center for Computing History published a video that's called In Conversation with John Romero. And as was the case last time when I link to a bunch of YouTube videos. I haven't watched it, but I anticipate it being very good. It's an hour and 46 minutes, and the Center for Computer History, I'm sure, is doing a good, thorough job of doing the interviews and capturing this. David, have you met John Romero?
Yeah, he... So I've been to Kansas Fest once.
That was what I was thinking, yeah.
Okay. I think it was 2013. And so he presented there. And, right? Was it 2013? Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so,
he presented one year. I wasn't sure if it was the year that you went.
Yeah. He was great.
Yeah. He was at the,
and I didn't know anything about him, frankly.
Right. Well, so yeah, he's probably, I think anyway, that one of the things he's most famous for is being the co-creator of Doom,
mm-hmm.
which completely changed everything somehow,
right.
in gaming.
Yeah.
And Wolfenstein 3D before that. In fact, I think so. Doom, I think, was originally created on a Next, and Wolfenstein 3D, I'm not certain, but it might have been on an Apple IIgs. But he's a bit of a star in the gaming world.
Right.
I have to admit that I didn't know him really either in advance of that. So it's a little bit disappointing, after the fact, after having, sort of hung out with him during that week at the conference, then realizing, oh, he was really famous.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he remembers
a lot.
Wasn't
he lead singer of Journey?
Quite possibly.
Kidding. He's got that sort of he's got long hair and he just strikes you as he's a rock star guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he struck me as being really nice. Anything I've ever seen him in, it seems like he's a real, real cool guy, laid back, like a real genuine person. So
yeah.
He came across like that.
And
but he looks like a rock star.
Right, I was going to say it's superficial, but his fantastic hair. Another thing too that's been really interesting about what he's been doing is that he has been really involved in the Apple II software and just basically Apple II history preservation. He, through his career has become able to, buy, collect things. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and he was an early contributor with, he worked a lot with, I think he worked with Softalk, but he definitely worked with Softdisk. And he did, he did some stuff with a lot of the game developers early on. And he has a very, very infrequently released podcast where he talks a little bit about, Apple II game development. And he just recently released a 3-part interview with Nasser Gebelli, Gebelli. You'd think I would know after having listened to this how to pronounce the software author's name. But at any rate, Nasser is what he was known by. And he wrote a lot of sort of very early influential Apple II games. And Nasser was completely, he basically made a huge amount of money co-founding Sirius and then just took off and left. And I think he's a very private person. And it took some convincing to get Nasser to talk on at all. So there's on his, I forget what it's called, Apple Time Warp, I think is what the podcast is called. And there's the most recent 3 episodes, I think, are interviews, 3 parts of the interview with Nasser. But he's also, he chimes in every once in a while with information about Sierra's history and things like that. And so he's really, he was at the time quite deep in the involvement of computer history, but he also is still doing it now. So anyway, I'm looking forward to watching this interview because I think I'm sure there's quite a lot of interesting stuff there, and I bet he remembers a lot just because he still kind of operates in that world a bit. Yeah, so you can
Coolio. I just said Coolio.
Oh yeah. Coolio. Coolio indeed.
I'll have to make sure to watch it too. Even though I was involved in some Doom LAN parties and stuff.
Yeah. Doom, man. I mean, I was never super good at it, and I never really got into much of the, multiplayers play, but it just blew me away. I mean, even Castle Wolfenstein, I was kind of impressed by that, but I didn't fall down too deeply into that. I think partly because I didn't have a PC of my own.
I didn't
run it.
Yeah, but Doom was, even though... just because the difference, of course, people look at it now and Doom is so primitive looking, but the difference in the graphics, how much better they were with Doom versus Wolfenstein 3D, but also, you know, so I'm thinking I'm playing it or watching some friends of mine play it, and they probably have 14-inch CRT monitors, right? Which is little, right?
Yeah.
Compared to now. But, you know, you had, it was completely 3D mapped, you know, the ceiling and everything, and the lighting and the stereo sound and stuff. It, to me, it was the first sort of game, first person shooter where it was just immersive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which seems hard to believe being, you know, watching on some little screen and all, but yeah, I was pretty impressed with it at the time.
I kind of wonder actually if like that's an experience that probably is really hard to recreate for anybody who didn't live through it, because that, like, all games turned into that. And now it seems like practically every game there is like watching a movie. It's super impressive. And at the time that Doom was released, I wished you could do what you can do now, but, I just don't think you can go back and be impressed.
Well, and think about sort of the rare, you know, luxury, if you will, of, more rare, I guess, of being able to play against your friends. I mean, you literally had to, you know, in 1995, you had to pick up your desktop computer and your display and all your stuff, and, or somebody else did, people all had to go get in a room together.
Yeah.
You know, and hook them up physically with, you know, Ethernet cables and stuff. But so I was able to go to a few of those LAN parties and check that out. And again, I was really impressed with it. Yeah. I was a Mac user, so I didn't have a PC. Mm-hmm. And, now, of course, that's something that's just nothing. There's nothing to it, you know, with your PlayStation or Xbox or whatever. But it was special back then.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Anyway, yeah, so.
Next topic is less than 3 weeks to the vintage. So I know there's a bunch of shows coming up. So first up is my show being, because it's the show I'm going to go to because it's where I live. Uh-huh. So 3 weeks from, so we're recording this on Sunday, April 1st. So 3 weeks from yesterday. So April 21st and 22nd, Saturday and Sunday, in Roswell, Georgia, which is just about 25 miles or so due north of Atlanta proper, Midtown, is the Vintage Computer Festival Southeast 6.0 is coming up. And so this is the sixth show. It's actually the fifth anniversary. That always confuses me. But whatever, it shouldn't, right? Because it started in 2013, so it's 5 years later, but it's the sixth show. And I know that works out, but it just doesn't seem like it should. In any case, so anyway, I'm excited. It's always been fun. And the show, it's mostly, I guess it's growing a little bit, but, you know, it's pretty much been keeping the basic same momentum. But hopefully this might be one of the biggest shows yet. Oh, what's changed too is, so the show was always held at a former CompUSA. Uh-huh. And that is not happening this year. So the show is in a new location, not too far from the old location. It used to be a Burlington coat factory. So if you can picture sort of a big, you know, like a department store size space.
Wow.
You know, JCPenney's or Sears, it's like that big of a space. And it's the future home of the Computer Museum of America. And they had hoped to open that in conjunction with the show. Now they're shooting for fall, but they're going to have a big display. And I know they're going to at least have a big display of supercomputers on display. They may have some other things, but I haven't heard that yet. But anyway, so you'll have that. And then you, of course, have the regular show.
Huh.
If you go to the links in the show notes there, I've been handling the Twitter feed for this. So anytime we get new exhibitors, I tweet it out. So I looked today, no new ones have been added, but I think there's at least 15 or so exhibitors signed up right now. And usually sort of we're getting to this last few weeks, there'll be some more that get added fairly quickly. But so check it out. I'm going to have a table. I think I have. Yeah, I've had every year. So mine's called The Evolution of Handheld Computing. So I'm going to have a bunch of different, handheld computers from some of the earlier DOS-based ones, like the HP 95LX or the Atari Portfolio, to the, you know, PDA-type devices, which obviously the Newton and the Zoomer and then the
Zoomer.
Motorola stuff.
Zoomer.
Yeah. It was a device that ran Geos and Tandy Radio Shack sold one, and also Casio, I think, made it and sold it too. I don't have one in front of me. And then I have some smartphones I'll have on display, and then organizers. So, the quick history I always tell about handheld devices is they evolved, failed, devolved, and then evolved.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Yes. So anyway, so I'm going to kind of tell that story on my thing. Because, you know, again, with the, I think like the Newton was a really good example of that, is it sort of built up a lot of expectation and, you know, this is the future. And then it kind of didn't live up to it enough and got bad press, even though it kind of came around, you know, was legitimately improved. It was too late. And so then all those type of devices failed. And then basically it wouldn't be for a couple of years when the Palm Pilot came out. You finally had a winning sort of handheld device that was, you know, small, relatively cheap, only did a few things, but did them really well. Yeah. And then that evolved slowly in conjunction with cell phones. And then ultimately in the early 2000s, you had this mating or merging of the two technologies where you had the, you know, the success of the BlackBerry and Palm phones. But in my opinion, because it's just my opinion, it really wasn't until 2007 with the Apple iPhone that I think the first true, legitimate smartphone happened. And of course, we all use them now, whether you use an iPhone or an Android device. But you're now walking around with a handheld full-on computer, and there is nothing it can do that a regular computer do other than the limitations of its size. You know, the screen size.
Yeah.
But you know, the iPhone was the first smartphone that had a legitimate both, you know, desktop quality email client as well as a web browser. And that's debatable, but you know, the BlackBerry had a great email client, horrible web browser, and so did the Palm devices.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's mine.
I had went through the Palm series, and I think the thing I had, what was it, a 650? Trio 650? Mm-hmm. That's what I had right prior to going to the iPhone.
My wife had one too. Yeah. And then it was like night and day, right?
Yeah.
You probably liked your Trio, and once you went to iPhone, it's like, what? This is garbage.
Yeah. Well, and my Trio actually still sits on my desk. It's still, you know, I replaced the battery maybe a year ago or something, and still charges, mm-hmm. and still, I remember it because there's an alarm and that sounds once a year.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about, you know, the story of like, you know, Steve Jobs and the Apple team visiting Xerox PARC, and they said, you know, Steve Jobs, once he saw the Alto, he was like, that's it. All computers got to be like this going forward. That's basically what the iPhone did, right? And it's true. There are no smartphones that aren't like the iPhone as far, you know, Android. It would not make any sense not to make it that way. BlackBerry tried and they failed by keeping the keyboard there and stuff. I know they make a device still with a keyboard. Anyway, enough of that. But they've got a bunch of great exhibits. Check it out. Let's see. We have two speakers. One is Michael, I think if I say it right, Tomczyk. But he was an early Commodore VIC innovator. And then also Scott Adams, who made Text Adventures early on.
Oh,
and nice. And he's well known in the Apple world, too.
Yeah, so. I think I've heard some interviews with him before. But Scott Adams, like the model that they pursued in order to, because they got their adventures on everything, because mm-hmm. They basically set up this kind of like sort of adventure source and interpreter model, so they could just port the interpreter to the different platforms and keep the basic game in all the different places. So they were immediately on, you know, all the TRS-80s and the Apples and PCs and, well, I don't know about PCs, but you know, Commodores for sure. And in fact, yeah, they even got a deal. There were VIC-20 cartridges. So I think that was, as I recall, that was kind of a big coup for them to get sort of exclusive cartridge rights. Be interesting to hear. He's another one of those people that I sort of get the sense that the distance isn't that great, that they still sort of are somehow mentally still in that time. Like they can remember
right
what happened.
So again, that's 3 weeks from now, the third weekend of April. And then about approximately a month later, you've got VCF East in New Jersey. And then you have the VCF West in August. And that's in the Computer History Museum in California. And then I guess what, Kansas Fest is July?
Oh, yeah. I failed to put anything in that in the show notes. But the registration just opened like a couple of days ago, March 30th. And the actual dates this year are July 17th to 22nd.
Okay.
And the keynote speaker is Roger Wagner. He wrote a lot of largely utility programs, I guess. He and his company was a pretty big player on the Apple II. So that's a pretty good thing. And also what's one thing that's kind of neat. Sorry that you mentioned Kansas Fest and then suddenly you've launched me. But
it's okay. It's your show.
Well, so fairly early on, this was a little bit more official convention of a sort. It was like a programmer's convention. And I think what ended up happening is that, so it became sort of increasingly unofficial. But anyway, Roger Wagner was one of the early regular attendees, and some of the traditions that they have date back to him. So these traditions don't really make any sense. They don't have anything to do with retro computers or whatever, but one thing that he is responsible for is starting this tie contest that they have every year where, you know, basically you're supposed to just, because I guess he was kind of known for always wearing crazy ties, and so it was turned into a kind of a, it was codified in a way so that there was an actual contest for, like, a crazy ties. And so,
oh, right.
There, you know, like, that's one of the things that happens at Kansas Fest, is there's a judging on tie craziness. Also, there's sort of a similar kind of contest for door decorations and things like that. I mean, you know, it all sounds like summer camp, and it is kind of, but.
And it's funny you mentioned that, because, and I was just looking, you know, for about Kansas Fest 2013, where I went, because the other speaker on that year, wasn't it like one of the guys from Beagle Brothers spoke too during that year?
There have been a couple of people who have spoken from, worked with Beagle Brothers and then, and then spoke.
So it could have been somebody else, yeah.
I'm just looking to see who this was. It might have been Randy Brandt.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. That name sounds familiar. I think that's who the other speaker was the time I was there.
I don't know. I don't think there's... You can't find an Apple II user that doesn't love that Beagle Brothers company just because mm-hmm. they were... there's a kind of like a humor behind everything. Yeah. That they did.
I loved them just from their, just, I was never a real Apple II user because, like I said, I started with a Commodore 64, then I went to a Mac, but I worked at an Apple dealer in the late 80s and I read, you know, Apple magazines and Mac magazines and I used to see tons of Beagle Brothers stuff, and I sold Apple IIs. So I really loved Beagle Brothers because I just thought everything they did was humorous, even like the 5 1/4 inch disc sleeves.
Yeah.
Like, don't put it in your dog's mouth and stuff like that.
So you remember that.
Sort of like Subway. Do you remember Subway would always have, like, wallpaper with all kinds of old newspaper-looking stuff?
Well, right.
And it seemed like Beagle Brothers used that sort of...
Yeah, it's like woodcut.
Type of print stuff for everything. It was always... Oh, and just so last, Paul, too, there's also Vintage Computer Festival Midwest, which is in the Chicago area.
Right.
And I haven't looked recently. I think it's September. So there's a bunch of them.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's... Didn't make it into the show notes, but all of these things are at vcfed.org.
Yeah, right. You can just go there too. But there's plenty of shows all across the year and all across the country. And, you know, obviously Kansas Fest specifically for Apple II and Tandy one for Tandy. And then, of course, VCF for everybody. We're not biased at VCF.
Even I should say that even Kansas Fest has, even in the time that I've been going there, it's sort of broadened a fair amount in terms of, the
Max, or
well, yeah, I mean, so John from the Retro MacCast shows up quite regularly.
Oh, right, yeah.
The Mac and the Apple II have kind of a, you know, not everybody loves them both. There are some people who dislike the Mac because it killed the Apple II, but
they should all hate Steve Jobs.
There's a fairly large Atari contingent that has been coming, and of course, you know, in reality, all of us are really kind of interested in all of the old tech. I mean, like, you know, so there's the little fights that you had in the playground about, like, whether your Commodore 64 was better than, you know, someone's Apple or
right
TRS-80 or whatever is, you know, those are at this point mostly just done in jest. Anyway, yes, all of these shows, go to a show. It's super fun to kind of, like, just nerd out with people.
Kansas Fest is the most unique, though, as far as it is one that's sort of like a camp. I mean, it really is a camp, really. It's the best way to describe it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, as far as you're not camping out, but because you're in sort of like a what is it? A dormitories.
Dorm. Yeah.
It's which a is college sort, dorm. Sort of like a, yeah.
It's still kind of roughing it in a way, but it's not...
I would have come back by now, but it's just always something's going on in my life where, and the thing is, if I go, I really want to, like, at least do, like, you know, at least 4 days in a row. That's right. Always hard.
Yeah. Yeah. So. The experience is best when you're kind of just on site for the week because, you know, then you can kind of spontaneously go do whatever, you know, whatever's happening. And there's so many people. I think it would be neat for there to be something like this for, you know, other communities. I mean, like, Kansas Fest is pretty unique and we end up talking about it a lot on the show. But, but even just, you know, just that sort of environment where you have a bunch of people you know, who all basically share varying levels of kind of like knowledge, but all share some sort of connection and interest in the in old computers, and usually with some connection with the Apple II. But I mean, it's also like whatever shared interests there are, you know, also get explored. You know, so there's people bring arcade cabinets and or big MAME machines and things like that, and or you know, their whatever their TRS-80 that won't start, mm-hmm. and get some help with, you know, putting that, getting that working. So,
well, let me just say, from what I know, the closest thing in the terms of the closest thing to Kansas Fest. Uh-huh. Would be the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest, because in the sense of a really great show. I mean, all the shows are really good, and they're all slightly different from each other. They have personalities. That show is unique in the VCF world, and what I'm saying, it's more like Kansas Fest because it's held at a hotel convention center. Right. So you have an opportunity of staying at that hotel. You can kind of, in other words, you know, you can immerse yourself in this thing for at least, you know, a Friday night and a weekend.
Yeah.
And then, you know, live there, if you will, sort of like Kansas Fest, but it's obviously not as long and, you know, not exactly the same thing.
Yeah. But that, I think that does kind of make a difference that, you know, yeah. If it's very easy to just sort of get back and forth, like if you have to sort of commit to driving across town at a certain time in the morning to make it to an event or something like that, it's, you sort of lose some of the interaction time. So, you know, if you go to something and see just the sessions and then go home, mm-hmm. you've missed part of it.
See, our show isn't really like that, and I live here, but, you know, if it was like that, I would probably stay in the hotel.
Yeah.
Just because
yeah.
So I can just hang out with everybody, but anyway.
Yeah. Actually, there was one thing, too, that I wanted to tack on to a previous topic, which was that we were talking about that, like the handhelds and stuff like that, and I knew that I had seen something about WebOS flash by my screen sometime recently. WebOS was the, you're probably familiar with this, but it was the kind of like last gasp of the Palm.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
It was the operating system that they moved to. And no Palm that I had ever could run it, but I did run something that would kind of like fake it a little bit. But it had these sort of application cards and things that you would use. And it looks like, so there's an article from just a couple weeks ago that LG wants to take WebOS beyond TVs with an open source edition. So I guess LG has been using it on smart TVs, and they're going to sort of bring it back to, I don't know what, refrigerators. I'm not sure exactly where, you know, like, but some little bit of Palm technology, it looks like it's going to still live on a little bit.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause Sprint had a phone for a while, or, you know, Palm, you know, they had like two different phones, I guess, that used the WebOS. And they did okay, but not great. Do you remember that? The Palm Pixie. Here it is. I just found it.
Uh-huh.
See, I've been with Sprint a long, long time. I didn't move to an iPhone until the 4S, because that was the first one they finally got.
I see.
And I was considering getting a Pixie at one point, and it looked really good, but, you know, it was an iPhone.
Yeah. Right. I've always had a sort of fond view of Apple, and I know that not everybody... Even not everybody listening here does, but I had a sort of similarly fond view of Palm. You know, like it seemed like a kind of like a friendly startup, you know, somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, okay. Anyway, so there is a not super, super recent article, but a somewhat recent article on a site called Socket 3. And I don't actually know much about this site, but it looks like, you know, a blog written by one of us, more or less.
Oh, Bits and Bytes on Vintage Computing. Okay.
Yeah. John from Ballarat in regional Victoria, Australia. Anyway, that's who the author is who is writing about this. But the article is called Designing Windows 95's User Interface. And it's basically just sort of talking about, it's sort of reviewing a paper that was written by a Microsoft employee named Kent Sullivan on basically the process of designing the Windows 95 interface. And by itself, that probably wouldn't have grabbed me that much, but it's actually quite interesting. So I think that much of the paper is actually just reproduced here. I think that's what we're reading. Yeah. So I'm not sure exactly where the paper was and why it was hard to find. Oh yeah. All right. The webpage that it was on had since been taken down. And so he's preserved it and reposted it in a way that you can read. But so it kind of just goes through the iterative design and testing and goals and things like that that they had when they were trying to put together this interface. You know, so this is trying to move from, I guess, what was before 95, 3.1, and talking about all the things that they changed and what they were trying to do and the way that they did it. And it's pages and pages long. I mean, it's really, it's quite involved and increases my level of respect for Windows 95 a bit more, actually, having seen what went into it. I mean, it's not, it's certainly not just copying the results of others. I mean, like, there's a lot of testing and thought and stuff that went into it. I still don't find the result that pleasing in some aesthetic respects, but it is really interesting to see why they made what decisions they made.
It was a huge improvement over 3.1. It was the first Windows that I was actually impressed with. It didn't want me to switch from my Mac, but I actually thought, wow, this is actually pretty decent, you know? Yeah. Cause, it's funny. I stood in line with a friend of mine who was getting it, you know, the night it came out. Uh-huh. He CompUSA stayed open to midnight, and then you had to stand in line, and they could sell it, you know, that first thing at midnight, that, you know, when it was released. And I stood in line with a friend of mine to get it, and he got like the plus pack, which gave you extra like screensavers and fancy stuff, and an Office. I mean, he spent a lot of money. I remember he also had a Pentium. He had bought a Pentium 60, and so he spent a lot of money on his system. And at that point, it was, you know, expensive as a Mac.
Yeah.
Like I said, it was pretty neat. I mean, it really, I certainly liked it, but I would not have traded my Mac for it. I noticed here too, the if you scroll down in the replies or what do you want to say, the actual
comments, yeah.
Yeah, comments. Thank you. The author of that document that was posted here, he actually comments on this. And then the publisher of his paper says, wow, I didn't expect to see something from you. So that's kind of interesting.
That's very cool. I had not even seen that, but you're right. There it is. And so it's that would be wild if you had written this article and then you see your comment, like the name of the person.
Right.
And it says, what a blast from the past.
But, you know, back in, I mean, I've been a Mac user a long time. And again, it's like, now I'm still a Mac user, but I don't dislike Windows. And I like Windows fine, in fact. And I use it all the time at work and stuff. But, you know, my personal machine is a Mac. But it always bugged me when people want to bash one or the other, whatever side they're on. Even a lot of Mac people want to be like, oh, Microsoft stole everything and they didn't innovate. They've never innovated. They just steal all their ideas. And it's like, come on. Yeah, Microsoft really did do some innovation, you know, of their own.
Right.
And then obviously the Mac has taken ideas from Windows, you know, or Unix. I don't know. But, you know, Apple's also borrowed ideas. You know, the Mac OS has also evolved and not completely independently. So...
Right. Yeah. I mean, my somewhat realistic, I think, interpretation of this is just that perhaps in the very recent history, quality control has not been so great. But what Apple, I think, would do is just really devote a fair amount of resources to the experience in a way that I imagine Microsoft devoted resources somewhere else.
Yeah, and I think that's been the biggest difference. I think Microsoft's gotten a lot better at it, but not to the point that Apple has more consistently always finalized things first. Mm. So, but cool.
Anyway, yep. So take a look at that if that seems at all interesting to you. And then I guess with that, it's time for a word from our sponsor.
Where is Newton? Newton's in small towns and hamlets. Newton's in the urban jungle. Newton can get you from the urban jungle to the nearest hamlet. Newton goes wherever people need to communicate. Newton can send a letter or a memo. Newton can be reached by a satellite. Newton faxes from places where there's no fax machine.
Yo, you got a fax machine?
Newton is everywhere. Well, that's not a bad place to be.
Where's Newton in relation to what? The universe or Des Moines?
And we're back. This time... I'm going to hand over the choice of retro computing gift idea to David. So what do we have this time?
So I found something I saw somewhere. I don't know, maybe it was on Facebook or something somewhat recently, and it's pretty cool. I have seen others of these. I know I've seen other projects like this, but they're a lot more expensive. Not that this one's super cheap, but anyway, to get to it, this is a keyboard. And it's you can get it Bluetooth, wireless, or wired. So it's just a little bit cheaper if it's not wireless. But it basically takes on the look of sort of like a classic typewriter, you know, so a really retro keyboard. So you got round keys and it's wood grain with like a metal framing around it. and there's like a metal framing around each key, you know, so it looks like a, what would you say, an early 20th century typewriter?
Yeah,
the way
yeah.
The keys.
It looks like something that you're likely to hurt your fingers on because you have to smash them down, but I'm sure that you don't actually.
And, you know, so it's just something, it's definitely retro and definitely very cool.
It has a nice little plaque or whatever. It says retro classic and it's like riveted down like a brass plate or something.
And I want to say that whoever made the other one, so there's a link to the site as well as an Engadget kind of a review webpage, but I know I've seen another one, which I want to say I almost thought was a little bit more impressive, but if I'm not mistaken, it was like $300. And this isn't much cheaper, but what is it, $219 it looks like? Let me go back over to the, I believe it's, the wireless is $219 and it's coming up. Yep. And then, or they make a the wired one for, you know, a little bit cheaper. I want to say $189. I'm not going to click on it. And you've got four different styles. So you have a Onyx, which is black leather with black chrome frame, Posh, white leather with copper matte frame, Artesian, black leather with copper matte, and then Elwood, which is walnut wood with gunmetal matte. And the white one almost looks like that apple rose gold sort of color.
Yeah.
Which maybe isn't just apple, but you know, whatever.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
They're really pretty fancy looking. It'd be fun to have that.
Yeah. And it's giving you like a full stroke keyboard too. I mean, so the way the keys feel, you know, it's giving you like the full, but it's a modern type of assembly. It has stuff on here about all that.
It's really pretty cool. The only thing I would hesitate about would be it is making a statement. It's not a neutral object.
Right. Well, and then for $200, I mean, yeah, the price is kind of, for me personally, if it was $100, and maybe they just can't make it that cheap. And, you know, and frankly, I wouldn't want it if it was just cheap. But, you know, I probably might consider getting one. But $200, that's just kind of, it's too much.
Right.
But there you go. There's somebody, you know, there's people out there that want that. It's cool.
Yeah, that's true. It definitely is. Okay. All right. So
back to you. That was a retro computing gift item.
Yep. Maybe a little more than a stocking stuffer, but I think we've had some fairly cheap ones recently, so you should have been saving a fair amount of money from that. And if you don't want to buy this keyboard, we can now turn to the eBay auctions and spend money there.
Right.
The way we've got this organized is alphabetical, so David, you're listed here first as well, but you might as well keep going, run through yours.
All right, yeah, and I'll go fairly quickly. So I've got, three of them, and so don't drag the show out too much. The first one I chose because it's from a gentleman named Mike Willigal, and I think, doesn't he come to Kansas Fest sometimes? Or no?
I don't know. He comes to VCF East, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, he does.
And he actually lives not too far away from me, but yeah, he's also an expert on the Apple One, and he made the replica. What does he call it? There's a specific Apple One replica that he makes, and it'll come to me.
Yeah, and he's made other replica devices too. Real nice guy. I've known him for a while. I don't know him that well personally, but in any case, he makes a reproduction Swift card. SWYFT. And what the Swift card was, so real quick history here is you had a guy named, many listeners may know this name. You had a guy named Jeff Raskin, and he was a very early employee of Apple. And, he basically was the guy that came up with the idea for a Macintosh project at Apple. His Macintosh though was very different from what Macintosh became, what Steve Jobs made the Macintosh. He really wanted a computer that would be very utilitarian, less than $1,000, and kind of no nonsense. He did have an idea that the machine would have a bitmap screen, but all the like Xerox PARC related inspired stuff, that wasn't what he was after. So he was big on the idea of, I was about to say ergonomics, and that's not correct, but what would you call it? User experience, or, you know, getting the most efficient usage out of a machine. Mm-hmm. We'll leave it at that. So he was not big on the mouse idea. He thought that it was more important to keep your hands on the keyboard at all times. So he developed an idea for something called Leap Keys. And when he first started developing these ideas, he made this card called the Swift Card, and it was for an Apple II. So you got this card, you stuck it in an Apple II, and then without using a graphical user interface with a mouse, you could more efficiently jump around the screen and jump around your document or jump around your spreadsheet or whatever by use of Leap Keys and other stuff. That's the real simplified idea here. So these cards are rare. They're hard to get. Oh, just by the way, so Steve Jobs got kicked out of the Lisa project, and then he decided to go commandeer the Macintosh project, make it into the Little Lisa, and he basically, you know, forced Jeff Raskin out, who left in disgust.
Right.
And then ultimately, Jeff Raskin developed a computer called the Canon Cat, called Canon, because Canon ultimately was the people that produced it and marketed it, and they did a poor job of it, and it wasn't really considered successful, but it utilized this technology. It had Leap Keys in it and stuff.
Right.
So in any case, back to this. So Mike makes a reproduction Swift card that you can stick in your Apple II, and you can have Leap Keys and all this functionality. It's very historic. It's really neat. It's not expensive. They're about $50 a piece on eBay. So there's a link in my eBay too. He's got 5 up here on eBay. So buy one for $50. You can put it together yourself. You do need a solder, but it's not too bad. So there you go. But I bought one from him, and I'm going to be displaying it at VCF SE. And also I got like 4 other ones that I'm going to, you know, put there. And if people want to buy them, I'll have them at the show, because I just thought I'd help them out. And I thought it was cool.
So did you say you soldered it together? You built it, or you just have the...
I actually asked him if I could get one already built.
Oh, yeah.
Because... Yeah, I can do it. It's just that the reality is, it's like I've bought other kits and I never find the time and all that.
Yeah. No,
and I really just want to get to the playing with it. Yeah. So I kind of made him a deal like, hey, if maybe you wouldn't mind getting me one assembled, I'll help you advertise at the show and stuff.
Cool.
So that's the story there.
Yeah. I think I have a kit too. I think I have not built
it. See,
I haven't
put it together yet.
Like one of the Swift cards. Yeah. I'm kind of looking forward to trying it out. I think it's pretty cool. I mean, like, did you not have a Canon Cat at one point?
I have, yeah. I had a Canon Cat.
You've actually,
before, yeah.
You've played around with the documents.
But I didn't have like the manual or anything, so it was, you know, so that was kind of hard to figure it out. But it was pretty neat. It was a very neat machine, and it would have been interesting. It's almost too bad that Apple maybe didn't sort of utilize more of that idea in the Apple II. You know, and still they could have made, you know, the Lisa and the mini Lisa, if you will, the Mac. And, yeah, it's kind of a shame that Jeff Raskin's Macintosh didn't come to be. I mean, I think we're all happy that we didn't get, that we got Steve Jobs' Macintosh, you know, but yeah.
But this was cool.
But, yeah,
it's
pretty neat. And, those are one of those machines too, where at some point we needed some money for something, I had to sell it. And I sold it on eBay.
Yeah.
So.
Well, they are... I mean, as a result of them not being so successful, there aren't many out there.
Mm-mm.
So, I think if I remember right, this one of the things that this, you know, Swift card system had that was sort of pretty kind of early was this kind of, it was a lot of relying on searching, you know, in a way that, mm-hmm. that
sort of a hyper
we do
text
now.
Thing too, right? Yeah. Also, I think you could do screen grabs and stuff, which was sort of unique at the time. So my next item I kind of stumbled on in my searching for items for the show, and I just thought it was cool. So I went for it. So it's an item. It says Burroughs Computer, Batman, Time Tunnel, Lost in Space, Print Prop, Excellent. And it's $48.95. Buy it now. $5.24 shipping from Texas to me anyway, in Georgia. So it's probably about the same. But basically what you're buying is this high quality print. If you can imagine the Batman TV series of the 60s and sort of what the Bat computer looked like. And it mostly looked like a white framed out sort of rectangular blinky light thing. That basically this guy made an accurate print, like a poster of that. And basically you're buying that. And then he'll give you like instructions for foam core. And then basically you can just mount it really cheaply and easily in the phone. You can make the little that thing that'll sit on the desk, and you can just use Christmas lights and make it into this functional looking little bat computer. But he said it was based on a Burroughs computer front face, and that this was basically used in tons of TV shows like Time Tunnel, Lost in Space, Fantastic Voyage, and so hundreds of movies, it says. So Space 1999, Star Trek. I don't know about that, but anyway.
That's
kind of fun.
Pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah, when you see the end result, I mean, in the eBay auction, it's kind of like, yeah, it's pretty neat.
Yeah, and it's just got those, like, yeah, like you were saying with Christmas lights, like the little, like, yeah, the very small little bulbs that you can just poke through the poster, I guess.
Yeah, it works.
Well, it works in that it lights up.
I think if you had that sitting somewhere or you mounted it on a wall or something, yeah, that would be pretty neat as a little conversation piece and yeah, so on. So then my last item is, with the whole General Magic thing, I did a search for a General Magic device. So General Magic was a company that made the operating system Magic Cap. So this is a rare vintage Sony PIC-2000 Magic Link PDA, they call it. So the original device was a PIC-1000. So I'm not totally sure what the difference is to the 2000. It looks the same. But they want $299, which I think is a little expensive, but they will do make an offer, and it's free shipping from California. But you can take a look at this and see that it works, and it has the screen lit up. I know the original one lit up too, was backlit, so that's not a difference. And you can see sort of the desktop metaphor that it used,
uh-huh,
and then it comes with a box. And
that's got an actual, like, 3D desk.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Pretty cool.
And then it had rooms, and you moved down a hallway and that kind of stuff. So it was kind of interesting. But there you go.
Huh.
So you can see what that's all about. And maybe someone really interested can talk that person down.
Yeah.
That's too much.
I've never really heard of this before. But, I mean, I guess you know, it was a little bit later than I was kind of paying attention to that, I guess.
But 94 for this device. And then, just by the way, you would buy a, essentially what was like a cellular card, and you would, like, a PCMSA card, and you'd, yeah, pop into it. And then it came with a, you know, sort of like earbuds, you know, it was like the little headset with the microphone. And then you could use it to make phone calls and stuff, but it was analog, of course, right, back then.
All right.
So what you got?
So, all right. Yeah. See, what do I have? I have a lot of random stuff, as usual. So the first thing I have a link to here is there's a couple of disk cases. Apple, it says, well, I mean, what it says is two vintage Apple computers, Macintosh 5.25 floppy disk holder case used.
Yeah.
But so the thing about this, like,
Macintoshes didn't use 5.25.
No. Right. Well, so clearly, basically, the person who's selling this doesn't really know very much about what these are. I mean, like, but they're, you know, generally speaking, they're kind of unremarkable. Like, they're 5.25-inch floppy disk holders. Flip and File made a bunch of these that were sort of the same kind of thing. But what I think is kind of interesting about these in particular is that, you know, so these are sort of like, I don't know, it's maybe like brown smoked glass. And in the lower right corner, they have a white disk with an Apple logo on it. Mm-hmm. And the seller doesn't know this, but these have a little bit of a historic value to them, in that these were actually sold in the Apple catalogs, like the gift catalogs. These were
oh, really?
These,
I would have thought someone stuck those on there.
No, these are actual things from, like, the 1981, you know, catalog, or whatever it is, like, and maybe 1982.
Nice.
But so the thing is that there's two aspects to this seller not knowing what they have. So one is that they failed to, since they didn't know what this was, they didn't advertise it as such, and, you know, they barely could even managed to get, they didn't manage to leave Mac out of it. But at the same time, since they don't know what this is and they don't know the market, they also priced them pretty high. So mm-hmm. if these had been just two generic disk cases, the buy it now price of $55 and 55 cents would not be reasonable. Mm-hmm. I think it's high enough that I just sat on this so long that I decided I'm just going to put this in my eBay auctions list and let someone else get this.
Right.
And, you know, it might just not sell and perhaps get relisted, but it's not, it actually is, you know, given that they're in pretty good shape and they are, you know, actual from the catalog Apple things, they might be interesting. If I didn't have one already, or maybe two, I probably wouldn't be telling you about this now. But since I don't, you know, all they really do is take up space. Once you have one, that's enough.
Yeah, if they could put, like, if they had put that in the ad that they're from the catalog, and maybe even put a picture of the catalog page, boy, that would probably go a long way to help them sell them.
Yeah. No, and I think that is a relatively unknown thing, because Apple did, you know, they gave out stickers and stuff with all their stuff forever. And so it's not that uncommon that someone will, like, you know, have like a toolbox or something that someone stuck an Apple sticker on, and then, you know, some their heirs try to put that on mm-hmm. eBay as like an Apple toolbox, you know?
Right.
But so I think when people look at this fairly normal looking object with an Apple thing on it, you know, the first thought is that, you know, it's just some normal looking object that someone stuck a sticker on, but this in particular was not. And so I think it could be overlooked. I mean, I think it's not universally known, but you can find the catalog. I can find it, but it's actually on the back page of, I think, one of those little gift catalogs that I think was from 1981. Anyway, I thought that was interesting that I would point that out.
I'll try to find it while you're doing your other auctions.
Oh, sure. Okay. So the next one I wanted to point out is it's an Epson PX4 that's being sold. It's currently in Toronto. So actually, maybe Carrington should have come just bought this. But I find it partly attractive just because the exchange rate is in my favor. So this is it's the price is to buy it now for $75 Canadian, although there is a make offer option. And that only comes out to, that's under $60 in US dollars. So this is another one of those ones where I sat watching this for a while and I wasn't quite committed enough. So I decided I would put it in this you know, the list for the podcast. But the PX4, I believe the PX4, now I probably am only going to be doing this from memory, but I believe the PX4 actually post-dates the PX8. Like, but it's supposed to be essentially in between the Epson HX20, which is a little, kind of like a less functional, but sort of similar form factor kind of, it's almost like a laptop. So these are, I probably should say, if people aren't already picturing these, the HX20, PX4, and PX8 are all, these little, probably about the size of a piece of paper, like a US paper, letter size paper. They have a full keyboard, nice, you know, tactile keyboard, and then little LCD displays. And the PX8 has a LCD display that kind of rotates up. And the HX20 had, and the PX4 had one that's just sort of like flat. And I think the HX20 and PX4 both have these sort of expansion spots where you can put in a printer or cassette interface, or there's various other things I think that can go in that spot. But so the PX4 is kind of in between the less capable HX20 and the more, you know, capable CPM machine, the PX8. And I think so this was supposed to kind of occupy that market spot. And I almost never see these. I mean, like, I see plenty of HX20s and plenty of PX8s, but I almost never see a PX4. So I thought it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The listing says it's an untested PX4 CPM computer that was bought many years ago with the intention to refurbish it and then is now being given up because that's never going to happen. So it's basically one of us. So I thought I would highlight it because I'm so close to wanting it. But I fear that I'm not going to, it's going to sit there unaddressed in my own piles as well as it did in this person's piles. So I don't know. Anyway, do you know the PX4 or anything about this?
I've heard of it, but I don't know a lot about it. No, I've had I've had like a couple of other variants.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I want to say the 20 maybe.
Yeah, the
HX20 maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never was able to do a lot with them. I think Earl knows a lot about these.
Yeah, yeah. He's a big fan of the PX8, and he has caused mm-hmm. me to become a fan of the PX8.
Mm-hmm.
No, they're pretty cool, and they are, you know, it's CPM, you know, in a little Model 100 size thing. So
yeah, and that's cool.
Yeah. All right, let's see. Okay, so this is a very brief mention, but someone is selling a PowerMac 75-100 owned by Industrial Light and Magic, and well, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous because it. I mean, they're not actually asking a huge amount for it, so it might be almost interesting just for that. But basically, it's a regular 7500-100, mm-hmm. you know. So it's from that era when all the Macs looked like this, and they had, you know, some number slash some other number. The second number is a PowerPC machine. The second number had to do with the speed of the processor. But what's interesting about this is, you know, it has a sticker on the front that says ILM. Mac 138 and a Lucas Digital Limited property tag on it. And
yeah.
So, you know.
And no RAM or hard drive.
No, like there's nothing, there's no data will have survived. So you're not going
to
find.
It's going to be harder to get the hard now to get the RAM and hard drive for it. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to know why he would want this, but like if it had the hard drive, then maybe there'd be some like early drafts of the Phantom Menace or something, you know, but no, there's it's really just something that somebody that worked somewhere near George Lucas touched.
Yeah. Right. They had probably had 1,000 of these.
Right. This is somewhere. There were 137 before this and who knows how many after.
And by the way, so when this came out, or roughly around this time, I was actually a Mac tech in the field, without going into that too much. But this is the same exact case that premiered with the 7200 series.
Yeah.
And it was a really great case at the time because you basically, all you had to do was, you know, you're facing the front of the machine and then you reach it around the front and your fingers underneath the case, you push two buttons and you slide the whole front off.
Yeah. I love this case. I agree.
Yeah, then you just undo two little things and you flip over the top right portion and then the other side, then you get full access to the logic board. It was great.
I think you rotate out, you can fully rotate out the power supply, I think, so that you can get it underneath it. And this is the Outrigger, right? Isn't that what that was called?
I'm not sure what it was called, but I know I had to replace logic boards and stuff, and yeah, this made it way easier. Yeah. It was not a big, difficult task. And in fact, most of the cases, the 8100 was a little bit of a bear, but then once you got into the, you know, this series and you got into the 8500, 9500 series, those were all great.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, because they all had the swing away and then, you know, the famous G3, then finally you had the big door that comes down.
Yeah. Those are pretty cool.
Technically, those took more time, though. If you had to replace a logic board or something, those took even more time, though.
Yeah. And you need more space for those. Too, I think. Like whenever I try to open one, it's always like I always have planned poorly and it doesn't open all the way because it hits something that I've got it too close to.
So. But I mean, it's kind of a boring design in some respects as far as when it's all closed and, you know, beige and all. But I always liked this design a lot. I always thought it was really clever and just really well thought out and, you know, easy to, as a tech anyway, it was really great to work on.
So one thing that I have found. Because I have a bunch of these things floating around, and if you can, I'm trying to figure out what a good picture to look at is, but maybe the, I don't know, whatever. There's a sort of obvious overhead picture, and there's a couple of little plastic sliders that you use to kind of like disengage. And I find that the plastic on those has gotten super brittle, so those break all the time. Which is sort of frustrating, but. So I think I probably have more broken than unbroken of those at this point.
Well, they're all like, you know, this machine atop my head was made in 96, I want to say. So 22 years old.
Yeah. Actually, that might be an interesting thing to try to 3D print as replacement things for those. But all right. I'll keep going here quickly. So there's a auction for a Televideo TS-803 vintage working computer. It's not a computer that I feel like I've had much experience with, but it seems to be working. It's got...
Yeah, CPM.
Yeah, the construction of it is actually sort of bizarre. Like, it took me a second to really understand it. But imagine, if you will, kind of like a regular computer, regular, you know, 80s computer where you have like a dual disk drive and then a monitor sitting on top of it. And imagine a situation where it is, in fact, connected. So not quite like a PET, but, you know, sort of loosely connected. At least the way this is set up, I'm not sure actually if it has to be set up this way, but the way it is set up is it's sort of turned on its side. So the CPU is on the right and then the monitor is to its left, but still connected, you know, it's still sort of like part of a single machine.
Yeah. Where normally you'd have a connected display above the computer portion always. And here it's connected, yet it's turned to the side and the screen is like then angled that way.
Yeah.
And right?
And it looks like you can, you know, it's sort of ergonomic, you know, so you can tilt the screen up and down. So it's not connected hard to the base, you know, it's allowed to, it can tip. It looks pretty cool. Oh, and it's got the manuals, and it's got a lot of discs. It's been shown to work. You know, looks really quite nice. It's a $400 buy it now. Oh, is it, David, when you look at this, does it ship to you?
Mm-hmm. Well, it says free local pickup, ships to local pickup only, it says.
Oh, okay. Well, so maybe that's okay. So maybe, so part of what made this catch my eye is that I've been seeing this actual machine on Craigslist for a year and a half. And each time I think, do I want that? Do I have a place to put that? You know, like, it's really pretty cool. The asking price has, you know, it's right at a level where I just can't quite justify it. Mm-hmm. And in the Craigslist ads, it was also mentioned that it was, I think it was in the movie Pretty in Pink or something like that. Like, not in no way that I can remember, but it's in some movie. Maybe not this actual machine, but I mean, like, this model. I always thought that was kind of a funny selling point. But it looks pretty cool, and I don't see many of these any other places.
So. I've never seen one before.
Yeah.
It is pretty cool, though. The guy's determined to get $400, huh?
I guess, yeah.
No matter what.
I mean, so there's no make offer option here, and I don't think I ever quite even wrote to the Craigslist ad. Anyway, yeah, it's an interesting machine. You know, I guess the one disappointment about having CPM run on so many platforms is that, like, I don't necessarily need a zillion CPM machines if they all, you know, if the same software runs on all of them.
Right. So. Yeah.
Okay, so the next one, I thought you'd think this was kind of nice. There's what I put in the show notes as some old computer newsletter, but it is issues 1 through 6. Like, it looks like they're bound together Starkly Brewed.
Oh, what, from the vintage computers? $100?
Yeah. So that's...
And it's got a coffee stain on it?
Yeah. I mean, this particular seller does tend to inflate prices generally. Yeah. In fact, I'm not sure if... You, like, I don't know how you viewed how you found your eBay picks, but I usually just kind of look at the vintage computer section, and I don't know what happened, but I think at like 4:40 yesterday afternoon or something, this seller just put his entire collection on. I mean, like, it's like 5 pages or something like that of just like nothing but the things that this seller is selling. And there's a lot of them are interesting, but they're also priced very high.
Yeah. And so this is, you know, I had did 6 issues and then I put them together into one book.
Uh-huh.
And then I had a little print shop print it, and it's okay quality.
Yeah.
I mean, the inside is at least as good as my, you know, my current book. Right. The outside you see is a little bit simple.
Yeah.
But
it's real. But
yeah.
I mean,
you
like
can buy
a
brand new one. It's got, all 9 issues.
Yeah.
You know, for $20. So it's kind of like, what? Yeah, I printed 200 of those.
Cool.
That was a big deal. So
that's kind of neat. Anyway, so you can see the actual historically brewed, but then if you want to actually read them, you can go to, we'll put a link in somewhere too, like where you can get the current one. Right. You still have those, don't you? Or are you?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Okay.
Every so often I print some more. So I have some.
Okay.
And I have those at the show too. But yeah, if anybody's interested, you can email me or just, there's a link in the webpage. Just buy one.
Yep.
I'll send it to you.
And just to backfill the details in case not everyone was completely following along, this is the newsletter called Historically Brewed that is about vintage computing that David edited, and has since then put all of the issues into a compiled book that you can get. At the length
I mentioned
about.
It was 25 years ago, so that's when I put the first issue out. So I started a group called the Historical Computer Society, and it wasn't a local user group. It was kind of the communication device was the newsletter, or the zine, we called it. So, yeah, and so over the years, I finally did 9 of them. And anyway, yeah, then I did a Kickstarter some years ago, so... I have more books. So it's called Classic Computing, The Complete Historically Brewed now.
Okay. Cool. I have it on my shelf.
Thanks.
Okay. And then the last one is really just a nothing. As I was looking through, I saw there a listing for a rare Westinghouse microprocessor IO trainer. I don't have any idea what this is. I just thought it kind of looked like a face. So.
Yeah, it does. Oh, it does.
So anyway, I thought it would be kind of a funny decoration. It's an expensive funny decoration since it's a $190 buy it now, but If you
so it's like the panel for it, but it must have had some other parts, obviously.
Yeah.
You know.
It does look like there's not much going on there. You know, that there's like a power input and there's some switches and like a set of like eight switches and eight lights and a couple of variable somethings, you know, adjusters of some sort. But it does sort of seem like it's got to be just standing in between some other functional objects.
Like something plugged into it that must have had the sockets.
Yeah.
You know, IC sockets and stuff.
Oh, this is from that same seller. Okay, that would explain why it's $190 decoration. But if you happen to be looking for a Westinghouse microprocessor I/O trainer box of this sort, there is one. Okay, I think I will leave it at that. So, and I think it turns out somehow, even though there have been only two of us here, it's still been 2 hours.
Yeah.
So I guess we probably should close it up. But did you have any sort of like closing thoughts you wanted to add?
Did I put anything down there? I don't think so. I mean, I think we covered everything. Thanks for mentioning my book. So, oh wait, I did. I know. I thought I put some. So the last thing I want to mention is, I did some good little interviews recently. So just go to my website, classiccomputing.com. But my other one's on YouTube. So I did two interviews with two gentlemen involved in Apple Lisa replacement boards. Did you guys talk about this? They're called Sapient.
Oh, yeah.
And you can repair your Lisa by replacing the motherboard, parallel card, memory, and what's the other one? I/O card, I think. So they have made completely compatible reproduction boards, you know, for the Apple Lisa. So I interviewed two key people. I'll leave it at that. So just check it out. Uh-huh. If you just go to my website, the link will be in the show notes. You can see that. And I did an interview with the creator and producer of that Douglas Engelbart documentary, and that is on YouTube. And it's pretty interesting. We talk a little bit more about Douglas Engelbart, his significance, and of course, specifically about the documentary and who he spoke to and things like that. So check those things out.
Yep. Cool. We did, in fact, I remember catching that when you're, those interviews went.
Okay.
And so it looks like we talked about this in January. So
yeah.
But they were still good. And now you've heard David himself say that they're good.
They're good. I approve.
Yeah. No, it's, I think it's really interesting. So this is Todd Meyer and, John Woodall. And I didn't know Todd, although I did know that they were working, you know, on this whole Sapient thing. John is like, he is the source for Lisa equipment in the modern age
and knowledge. So he's a good resource for parts. And I should have mentioned in my interview with John specifically, we talk a little bit about the board project, but more so about him and his history and how he came about to being essentially the Lisa guy after basically a company called Sun Remarketing went south, you know, bankrupt. He bought up a lot of their inventory. So he basically became the guy in the United States that had all the Lisa stuff, you know, from parts to the new old stocks, you know, Lisas. And anyway, a lot of interesting stuff there. Mm-hmm. He's handled a lot of Lisas in his time.
Yeah. Yeah. On Facebook, there's a Lisa group. Mm-hmm. And he started, like, you know, posting some sort of like photos of interesting things that he's had along the way. And things.
A lot
like
of great photos. And there's some of those photos are in, if you go to the interview on my site, there's some of those photos there. Not all of them, but yeah, really neat stuff. Like a few of like the trucks when he first bought a lot of the inventory. Yeah. And yeah, it's funny to see two big pallets full of Apple Lisas.
Right. When they're I was going to mention actually on that Facebook group, there's a survey somebody posted about like, you know, how many Lisas do you have or something like this.
And I saw that.
So, you know, I participated in the survey. And
then have?
I have one. I have one, and it's a Lisa 2. It doesn't have a widget inside, so whatever that means, it is probably a 210. It has not been converted to an XL. So.
Okay.
So I looked at the survey results, and, you know, many people are saying, I have two, I have, you know, five, I have, you know, more than 20. It's like, okay, wow. Well, I thought there was a time when I thought having one was an accomplishment.
And it is still. They're getting hard to come by, at least at a reasonable price.
Yeah. Anyway, but I do really kind of like it. So the one I have doesn't actually start right now, but I think it's the power supply that's not providing the necessary power, which is annoying.
And he's got some. He's got extras if you need one.
Yeah.
I think he mentions it in an interview.
Yeah. I've seen like a photo of like, you know, a fort basically built out of power supplies.
Yeah. Right.
But the dumb thing about the power supply is that it has there's some of the video adjustment circuitry in the power supply.
So you have to have that power supply. You can't like make another one or whatever.
Right.
Actually, I think we talk about that. We just touched on that a little bit, I think, in my interview with him.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it controls. And also when the power supply starts, like my original Lisa, the power supply, I think I ended up replacing it. It started going a little bit, you know, goofy. And so you get these wavy lines going in the pixels on the screen.
Right. I do hope to bring that back up because that's the Lisa is one of the kind of nice sort of impressive pieces that people can kind of recognize. Like it is, I've got it on a cart that's essentially displayed. So see how I'm not a hoarder, you know?
Yep. And you're proud of it.
Yeah. But it would be better if I could turn it on. Although the problem is then, you know, I would say, oh, see, I can turn it on. And then we have to sit there and wait.
Yeah.
For whatever, 7 minutes.
Well, that's what started it all for me. That's really what, you know, in my book, I added my story, you know, and so really it all started with the Lisa for me. My first Lisa. Yeah, it was my first Mac.
Didn't you say that Sony like stole your Commodore 64?
Yeah. Yep. They did.
Sorry, man.
I know. It was the one only time in my single life I had my own apartment, and I had a bedroom set, and I had like a basic little dining room set. I had no living room furniture, but I had a 13-inch color TV, and I had a Commodore 64, and I had moved in, and I started messing around with the Commodore, and all I had was a Commodore, so I didn't have a cassette tape or disk drive, so I had to leave it on. You know, the same I was doing, right? So I was messing around in BASIC, and I left it on for a few days, and I worked in a restaurant, and like a dummy, I left the TV on, so and then, you know, I turn all the lights out and go to work, it's night, and I don't have curtains yet on my back glass sliding doors in Florida. So some neighbor had a big party, and so someone smashed my glass sliding door and took him.
Yeah.
Took the Commodore and the TV, so they saw it glowing in there on the floor.
Very frustrating.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Didn't but anyway,
yeah.
Now I've got three of them, so it's okay.
Right. and as for me, I don't know. I'm just trying to make it through with the piles of things. I think that's probably all I need to say. I don't think there's any. I haven't gotten any new, interesting acquisitions or anything.
Now I don't know if you'd want to do this. Try to if you were to do like a video, like I'm trying to maybe move towards YouTube more.
Yeah.
And you know, that would make you get your hands into them and like do, you know, like do a highlight of each one sort of a thing, you know.
Yeah.
I thought about doing that one time and never did either, but.
I definitely have. I mean, like that's actually kind of what I would like to do. You know, when I sort of isolate a thing and I want to document it, I do want to have, I don't want to just take pictures of it. I want to be able to sort of like rotate around it. And so you can see like what it is like in space. And so, I mean, part of that, like, I have a camera I can use for this. That part of it is really just, you know, finding a place to put the thing that I, and actually before I do that, cleaning it off and that kind of stuff. So,
right.
But yeah, I would definitely like to do that. There's a particular magazine that I'm almost done scanning. There's a magazine called Soft Talk that was a big, you know, it was a big deal for the Apple II. In, I think it was 1982, they started a PC version of it. So it was called Soft Talk for the IBM PC. And that, until 6-7 years ago or something like that, I'd never even heard of this. I mean, like that was totally news to me that there was a Soft Talk, because Soft Talk was one of these beloved magazines for the Apple II. I didn't realize that there was a parallel one for the PC, but there was. And somewhere in there, I think there's someplace on the internet cites an article by, I think the guy's name is John Socha, in one of those magazines for inventing the screensaver. So there's this article that sort of talks about, it sort of sets something up, you know, does some sort of terminate and stay resident thing that will blank the screen, you know, to save your monitor's phosphors. And apparently this was basically the first, I'm not actually sure what is claimed about it. So I don't want to repeat a false claim because it seems almost insane to me now that I say this out loud, that this could be the first, but I've been repeatedly asked by people, you know, will you scan this article? So I finally decided I would just do this. And unfortunately, the article is in the December 1982, or maybe it's 1983 issue, which is like, it's December, so it's the gift guide. And it's Soft Talk in its heyday. So the magazine's like 350 pages long or something like that. So it was quite a scanning task. But pretty soon, that article will be out there. So that's basically what I've been doing.
Archive.org?
Yeah. I'm at this point, I'm just putting everything I scan there and linking to it there. I still have a lot of
There's so much good stuff out there, by the way, anybody listening, especially all kinds of great magazines. There's one of my favorites is one called Info for the Commodore 64. Have you heard of that one? It started off called Info 64.
Yeah, I think
And then became more Amiga, you know, took it over. And it's just called Info. But it was very inspiring to me back in the early days when I started my zine, because those early issues, the guys that made it, they did it all on Commodore 64. So they were very except for the very last step. So in other words, they would create the entire magazine, every bit of it, and print the masters if you were using nothing but Commodore 64 related peripherals. And then the last step, of course, then they took it to a print shop and had it duplicated, right, you know, and put into a proper printed magazine. Right. But which, you know, that's not really cheating. You have to do that. And, you know, so I always thought that was great. And it's just really homebrewed, but professional enough. But anyway, there's so much other good stuff on the Internet Archive.
Yeah. No, and so a lot of sort of like whatever retro computing archiving stuff, you know, software and scans and all that stuff has been dumped up to the archive. But just because it's there doesn't mean anyone's really looked at it. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff to discover there that you might be the first to discover. So it's definitely worth, you know, sort of perusing what's there, because I think, you know, a lot of effort goes into the scanning of things, but that process isn't the same process as analyzing it.
Right.
So, anyway, maybe that's it.
We better go.
Yeah. So, all right. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast, and you can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, and please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And so, until next time,
retro compute.